And this is Morning Edition on New Hampshire Public Radio. Let's welcome Josh Rogers, NHPR's political reporter, in for the political front. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, Rick.
Okay, Josh, let's start with the events of last week. The video footage captured in Nashua that showed police punching a man as he appeared to surrender after a car chase that began in Massachusetts. And, of course, the shooting of two Manchester police officers by a suspect with a history of mental illness.
Sure. Both incidents touch policy debates afoot in Concord now. Body cams have been getting a look from policymakers for some time. What appears likely to happen this year is a policy that would codify when and how body cams might be used by local law enforcement. A good deal of the debate locally on body cams is focused on the context in which cameras would be permitted during enforcement situations, basically, and when they wouldn't, when police were in schools or during interviews with crime victims, for instance. But officials haven't confirmed if any of the officers involved in the Nashua incident wore body cams. But we do know that the New Hampshire trooper who's been put on leave pending the attorney general's investigation of the incident wasn't wearing one because state police in New Hampshire don't wear them.
All right. Now, my recollection is that at least one of the body cam bills started out as a proposal to require state police wear cameras.
It did. The cost of outfitting every trooper with a body cam, which had been estimated to run in the neighborhood of $500,000 up front and then about half that total again annually, led lawmakers to head in a different direction pretty quickly. But I think it's also fair to say that state police weren't clamoring to move past dash cameras, which many of their cars now have, towards body cams. And last year, when state police were planning to test out some donated body cams donated by a potential vendor, that never happened. I expect last week's incident to help lawmakers move towards a deal on body cams. Governor Hassan she's trod pretty lightly on this whole issue, but she has signaled that she'll probably back a body cam bill if it reaches her.
Okay. Josh, let's turn to the shooting in Manchester on Friday. We know that two officers that were shot are both recovering. They're out of the hospital, and that Ann McPherson, he's the shooter, will be arraigned today on two counts of attempted capital murder. Now, we know that McPherson's family over the weekend says that Ann McPherson had suffered from mental illness.
Yes, schizophrenia, according to his family. And as quoted in the Union Leader yesterday, McPherson's father said that his son had been ill-served by New Hampshire's beleaguered mental health system, as had the officers he shot, McPherson's dad added. McPherson's father said his son had sought help at hospitals, that would be given medication, and then be back on the street shortly thereafter. Putting aside the specifics, which we obviously don't know, the complaint that mental health treatment can be hard to come by in New Hampshire is a pretty common one. We'll obviously be learning a good deal about Ian McPherson very soon, possibly today. But one thing that's been frustrating for some lawmakers at the State House, and this incident, fairly or not, may inflame it, is that a year after completing work on a new 10-bed unit in New Hampshire Hospital to help handle people in mental health crisis situations, that unit is yet to open. It's supposed to open in July, though.
Josh, another question is why McPherson would this guy with a history of mental illness, and according to his family, had some run-ins with the law, why he had a gun in the first place, too?
Sure. That's a good question. And if they don't already know, police will be trying to sort that out. And the political tension that tends to ensue when the Second Amendment and mental illness collide is obviously nothing new nationally or locally. I mean, if you recall a couple of years ago, post-Newtown shootings, when some lawmakers at the State House wanted a bill that would have prohibited anyone with a court finding a mental illness from buying guns, the idea quickly bogged down. Right now, the only gun bills pending in Concord are two bills that aim to ease New Hampshire's current approach to carrying concealed weapons. Both seem likely to make it to Governor Hassan's desk. One proposal would get rid of the permitting process entirely. The other would require police chiefs to issue permits to anyone legally qualified to have a weapon, kind of a shall versus may, a change to the law. House and Senate negotiators still need to come to terms on common language, but the end result is fairly certain at this point. Governor Hassan, she's vetoed similar bills in the past, and she says she'll do the same if she gets them this time.
All right. Thanks, Josh.
You're welcome, Mark.
That is Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. He joins Morning Edition often to talk politics. Follow Josh on Twitter, by the way, at Josh Rogers, NHPR.
Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Renee Montaigne, with an appeal to look anew at a notorious American, Benedict Arnold. His name is synonymous with treason. And historian Nathaniel Philbrick wrote about the Revolutionary War general who sold his services to the enemy in 1780.
This was huge news. This was inconceivable to the American people. Here, one of the great heroes of the Revolution had dared to betray them. And, and this was a republic they were trying to form, which meant that Arnold had not betrayed a president or a monarch or a dictator. He had betrayed every American citizen.
Phil Brook sought the story behind that news for his book, Valiant Ambition. He spoke with R. Stevensky.
Philbrick wants you to know that Benedict Arnold was a hero before he turned traitor. And just how he turned is a complicated story. Arnold made his name in upstate New York, fighting for control of a chain of rivers and lakes. His men hacked together little warships and took extraordinary risks to battle a British fleet.
He was very aggressive. He reveled in risk so that it was kind of unnerving for those sometimes following him, because you knew that Arnold would always make the big play. And more often than not, it would work. After the Battle of Valcour Island, that battle on Lake Champlain, at night he broke through the British line and was able to get his entire fleet out before the British realized it.
I want to make sure this is clear to people. It's at night, his fleet is trapped by bigger British ships, and they just sneak right out between the British ships in the darkness?
Right. His second-in-command said, wait, let's go the other way and take the long route. And he said, no, I think we can get through. And so he snuck through the very narrow line between the end of the British vessels and the shoreline. And it was morning. They were many miles down Lake Champlain before the British commander realized it. And, this was classic Arnold.
So how did this courageous soldier, repeatedly wounded in battle, turn against his new country? Philbrick tells a story of a man who felt extremely underappreciated. The trouble intensified when he served as military governor of Philadelphia. Long before he turned traitor, Benedict Arnold was the target of paranoid investigators who suspected him of treason. He was also short of money.
Going into the revolution, Arnold had been very well off, and he had donated much of his own personal money to the cause. And after suffering these grievous wounds at Saratoga, he began to think it was about time he started making some of that money back, and he was not above using his position as the top military personage in Philadelphia to his advantage.
How was it that Benedict Arnold began corresponding with an officer in the British Army?
Yes, well, he had married Peggy Shippen, and her family was part of the British hierarchy prior to the Revolution. And so they were always suspect after the Revolution broke out. And she had greatly enjoyed the 8 months during which the British had occupied Philadelphia and had socialized regularly with a group of British officers that included Major John Andre. And it's no surprise, perhaps, that after marrying Peggy, within a month, Arnold began a correspondence, a secret correspondence, with John Andre about possibly turning his loyalties over to the British.
How did he phrase that?
Well, he felt that the country was falling apart in the midst of the revolution. This was an act of loyalty from his perspective, in that he was doing the best thing for the American people.
Did he have reason to believe that?
Well, yes. He was not the only one who was appalled by what was happening. We're now getting into the fifth year of the revolution. This was not a God-ordained march to freedom. It had stagnated. The French had come in on our side, but that had done nothing to win the war. The American people had seemed to have lost all the fervor they had had in 1776. Washington's army was languishing. And so Arnold felt that the time had come to stop this experiment and to return to the British. And there were others who obviously did not go that far, but who were very upset with where the country was in 1780.
You also describe almost McCarthy-style witch hunts for potential traitors, and people were coming after Benedict Arnold, who saw himself as a huge patriot up to that point.
Yeah, I think many of us don't realize that how ugly it got within American society, where the revolution devolved into a kind of civil war. It was often the militiamen would become kind of thuggish enforcers and sometimes dragging people out of their houses. It was a very desperate and despairing time.
Whenever I cover politics today as a journalist and I hear people questioning other people's loyalties or worrying about foreign influences, I wonder if some little part of that goes all the way back to the beginning.
Absolutely. And there were people who questioned the alliance with France. France had been America's perennial enemy. What are we doing? They're just going to take us over if we happen to win.
So what was the deal that Benedict Arnold finally made with Major John Andre of the British Army?
By 1780, Arnold had been able to win command of West Point, which was the foremost fortress on the Hudson. And the deal was that if he turned over West Point to the British and was awarded a sum of more than 10,000 pounds, which was a lot of money back then, this would be the plan that could very well turn the revolution around. Americans' fortunes were at their absolute nadir. And so this was the deal Arnold worked out with John André in a very dramatic midnight meeting on the west bank of the Hudson. And if André had not been captured on his way back to New York, it very well could have happened.
You've pointed out that the revolution was not a shining easy success. It was a long slog. It was a mess. In the years after that, Americans consciously polished that history and published biographies of George Washington that were partly made up, or of Patrick Henry that were almost entirely made up, and made everything look really great. At the same time, did Americans go out of their way to make Benedict Arnold look even worse than he was?
Absolutely, because what was being formed in the early 19th century was a kind of American Genesis story. And we had our hero, Washington, and we needed to have our villain, and it was Benedict Arnold. And so it was very uncomfortable to think that Arnold, who was such a great general, had reason to begin to think about turning sides. It was much more comfortable to believe that he was evil from the start. And I think in that, Arnold has been a real casualty of that tendency in America.
Nathaniel Philbrick is the author of Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And he was speaking there with our Steve Inskeep. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
I'm Rick Ganley. Our news is next. Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from you, our listeners, and from Antioch University New England. With master's degrees, elementary teacher certification, and marriage and family therapy, accepting applications for the fall until July 1st. AntiochNE.edu. And McLean Middleton, representing healthcare providers on a broad range of legal issues, online at mclane.com. It's just about 8 o'clock.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.